fish, 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 fish. I've gone fishing, hook, sinker, and line. I said fish, 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 fish. And good morning, good day, good evening, good night, and farewell and so long and hello and all those other good things that all tend to go together but don't really have anything to do with anything. Let's say, yeah, Peace River's coming up a little bit down here in Southwest Florida, and we are in the center of the known universe, which is downtown Northport. There is no other greater center than that. A little bit of rain we've had is starting to bring the river up. We're back up to about half a normal. So it's still pretty slow out there. And lots of strange things. In the truck, while we're driving up here to do the show, I was actually helping Robert with his spelling. Now, we know that the world, there's something wrong with the flow and ebb of the universe when I'm actually helping Robert with his spelling. Now, something, one planet is misaligned with another one. It could explain everything that's going on today.
It was the two different meteor showers we had this week that really threw it off.
It was, you think, did you get hit in the head by the meteor, or did I?
No, it's just the dust that's in the atmosphere is kind of trickling down on us and throwing it off.
Stardust.
Yeah. Stardust, yeah. Yes. And speaking of stardust, that's Robert in a chair across from me. That's RJ in command and control. And I'm Fishing Frank. Yes, sir. That. And this is This Week in Fishing. And This Week in Fishing, the number one fish out there, hot, ready, set. Robert, what's our number one fish of the week?
Kingfish.
Kingfish.
Yeah.
King mackerel.
King mackerel.
Yes, kingfish.
Sorry,
is a whiting.
Right. You're right. I apologize.
That's okay.
So, yes, king mackerel.
Suck up all you want.
All right, so
apologize.
Then, and then I'm going to take back my surprise then.
Yeah. No, king mackerel are showing up in pretty darn good numbers out there just off the beach.
I told you I had to help him with his spelling.
Yeah.
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 Go ahead. Yeah. Go ahead. Kingfish. Kingfish guy.
Yeah.
Showing up out in the Gulf.
Kings, yeah. Well, we could call them Gulf kingfish.
Well, there's, yeah. There's not, the, it's pretty rare they come up in the harbor.
Very rare. You know, but we do see once in a while where a big adult comes in, but we do see where the juveniles will mix in with the Spanish mackerel.
I had a suspicion Robert had a, you know, like a latex fetish and wanted to dress up in a suit and go out there with a mask and watch for kingfish. That was, for some reason or other, I just had that impression.
That's a weird visual.
Yeah, I have nowhere to go with that.
Yeah, I don't know where to go.
I'm glad.
With that.
Okay,
me
so
too,
anyway, they don't come
out
in the harbor very often, but out in the Gulf of Mexico, how far out are they?
Anywhere from a mile to up to about 20 miles. I mean, guys are seeing them scattered everywhere. There's so much life and bait out there. And this week we've had some pretty predominantly easterly winds, but a little bit lighter compared to the last month, really. So quite a few guys have been getting out there. And the amount of bait, cigar minnows, thread fins, Spanish sardines, and some greenbacks, that there's just fish popping everywhere. I mean, guys were actually seeing Bonita blitzing 1 mile offshore and catching them.
Wow.
Which is, I mean, a mile offshore, what is that, about 12 feet of water? Maybe?
20, 25.
Really?
Yeah, it, mile out, they're probably 20, 25.
Okay.
But I forget, how far out is the last marker in Boca Raton Pass?
6 miles.
So is it, that's in 6 miles?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, I could, you know, hey, I've had a rough week, I'm telling you.
Yeah, Frank's looking a little ragged in here today, guys.
Got to tell you, it's been a tough week. I would like to be out there doing a little trolling for king mackerel. Now, one of the things that I always want to consider is everybody's hot and heavy on the braided line nowadays. But when I'm trolling, One of the things I really like trolling for, or using when I'm trolling for king mackerel, is spoons.
Right.
And if I'm trolling with spoons, I want to go back to monofilament line. I don't want braided on a spoon.
Why is that?
When it twists up, it's junk. I can't drag it straight. I've tried a few times, and maybe if in the heavier lines it would work, but something about the when monofilament line gets all twisted up when you're pulling a spoon. Now, putting a swivel on the end of a spoon does zero good. It's not a swivel. It's a line connector. Unless it says ball bearing on the package. Because swivels are a metal-on-metal connection. Now, I don't know about you, but once you put two pieces of metal together, that's not going to slip and slide. So if you're going to troll a spoon, you have to use a ball-bearing swivel. But even with a ball-bearing swivel, you're probably only going to eliminate maybe 80%, if you're lucky, of the line twist.
Right.
I would, realistically, it's probably about half. Because that spoon's going around so fast that as you're trolling them, they tend to spin. Where when you're reeling a spoon in, you actually kind of want it to wobble. If it's rolling over spinning, you're actually reeling too fast. But trolling, even at 2 miles an hour, you tend to get that rolling action to it. Well, you pull something for 45 minutes, it's done several thousand rolls back there. You know,
yeah.
And that's a lot of twists. It's like taking one of those old-fashioned toys, the airplane with the rubber band and the propeller,
okay.
And you just keep cranking it up with your finger, and pretty soon the rubber band is twisted, and then it starts to knot up, and then you let it go, and it goes like heck. Well, when you're using monofilament line, and it gets all twisted, the monofilament actually ends up looking kind of like wrought iron, that twisted look to it.
Right.
And I think, and then you take everything off, no swivels, no leaders, no lures, no nothing, just bare line, put it outside of the boat, let out a little more line than what you were trolling with, say an extra 10 yards, and wait for a minute, and then tighten your drag up, start to reel it all back in on your, and you reel in brand new line again. No more twists, no more tangles, because I think the water captures in that twisted thing, and it actually, it's like rubbing your fingers down the line to get it straightened out. So with the braided line, it doesn't seem to work. I've tried untwisting it, and I've drug it for 5-10 minutes, and now and it may not be true for every brand of braided line, but the ones that I know of, I can't get the twist out of. And braided is so expensive. So yeah. If you want to replace $20 to $50 worth of line every time you troll a spoon, awesome. You know, I'm in the business of selling line. So, and I have good friends in that own line companies. They're all going to like it if you do that. But if you're going to troll with spoons and you simply take a couple rods you don't use often, reload them up back with monofilament, save the braid for your other rods, and troll your spoons off of those rods, you can easily drag the line straight, bring it back in, and the Big King spoons, the Lure Jensen's got a couple of nice ones, Clark spoons, the Gator spoons. Oh, God, there's so many good spoons you can troll for king mackerel.
Right. And even if you're from up north and you did a lot of trolling for lake trout, almost every one of those giant spoons will work equally well.
Oh, yeah, lake trout spoons work real good. Anything a muskie would hit or a big lake trout, king mackerel hit.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, another thing with the monofilament, me personally, I like the monofilament because sometimes I don't set my drag appropriately when a fish hits, and that monofilament having that extra stretch when that fish wants to make a sudden surge, because king mackerel got two speeds, haul butt and disappear.
Right.
You know, so it's really hard to sometimes, even though you're fishing open water, me personally, there's been times where I've just set that drag just a hair too tight and pop fish off, especially with braided line. And I found with mono, I have much fewer breakoffs. I've got room for error.
Yeah, monofilament's much more forgiving. And 30-pound mono holds about as well as 50-pound braid while you're trolling.
Oh, yeah, easily, I think.
I would go 30-pound mono against 50-pound braid any day.
In a heartbeat, yeah.
But monofilament's actually stronger, more forgiving. It's people don't believe that. Oh, braid is so much stronger. Yes and no. If I was going to, like, tie off something to the ceiling and put a chair on it to hold my weight up, and if I drop down a few inches, I would die. Well, I want braided because it doesn't do any of that. Where monofilament, you take the same strength, tie it on, you sit on it, you're going to drop 2 or 3 feet.
Right. You're going to stretch out. The only time I kind of, and this is a 50-50 wash for me, was with trolling with braided line, is like when using some of the depth-specific lures, is that it has less line drag going through the water.
Now, I'll go with you on depth-specific lures. Rapala has the ones, and you look on the box, it will tell you how deep it goes. And 12, 15 in the name probably gives you an idea. It goes 12 or 15 or 30 or 40 or whatever the name is. But if I'm going to do braided with lures that are going down, I agree with you. I'd rather have the braided in that aspect. Now, let's say I want to do it with a spinning reel. Mm-hmm. What I'm going to do is put the lure in the water while the boat's moving forward around 2.5 miles an hour. I don't like going faster than that during setup because I want to be able to get everything out, not have to hold real tight. And I take the spinning rod and I loosen the drag up, put the reel in the water, bring it up, set it in the rod holder that I'm going to troll with, and now I'm tightening the drag down. Once I get the drag just tight enough to hold the lure where it will not go back away from the boat, that's all I'm going to tighten it. I don't want it any tighter than that. I just want it so that if I'm hitting a wave, it doesn't pull any line. I just want it just that tight. Now, when a fish hits, starts peeling all that line off there, I take the rod out of the rod holder, reach forward a little bit, put my fingers against the spool to hold it tight, jerk back real hard once, and let go with my fingers. So the object is, the drag is pretty loose because it's just holding the lure in the water. The fish hits, he starts taking off with it. I got to set that hook in there because a lot of these fish, the mouths are real, real hard. So I put my fingers up against the spool, jerk back with the hook set, and while I'm coming back, I'm letting go with those fingers because all I want to do is set that hook. I don't want to take a chance on breaking the line. Now I've got him hooked, he's on, he's run a little faster. Now I can start to adjust my drag a little tighter to fight the fish. And I can work with it, slowing him down. And I don't leave, once I get the drag setting, I'm not big on leaving it there. Sometimes I might want to back it down. But the one thing I do is whenever I'm fighting bigger fish with braided line, I have the drag a little looser than I want it. I don't want to get it all the way to tight, because I can reel forward, dropping the rod tip, put my fingers up against the spool, pull back while holding the spool, and if I think it's getting a little bit too much, I can just let go of my fingers and the fish can have line again. I don't get broke off that way. You cannot adjust the drag cap looser and tighter fast enough, accurately enough, so you're going to lose fish, you're going to break off. They're either going to take all your line, they're going to pop off, but by using my fingers up against that spool, pulling back with it, then reeling forward, grabbing and pulling back, reeling forward. You got to pull up, let go, reel, pull up, let go, reel. So it takes a bit to learn how to do it, but once you got that down pat, you're going to lose 98% less fish by using your fingers as the drag,
sure,
rather than the drag cap as the drag.
No, I agree with that. You know, and you tend to get too excited also when you finally hook that fish and you put one crank too much on that spool.
there's no setting for it. That's why people use lever drag reels, conventional lever drags. You have conventional reels, like say a Pen 4-aught or 6-aught. Now, then you go and look at like a Fathom, which has a lever on the side to adjust the drag. Now, keeping in mind, that's just an adjustment. The actual drag setting is done on the knob, almost identical to the star drag. It's just round, you tighten it up, and you get so your perfect drag setting is in the strike. And you can go a little bit more than that, or you can back all the way back down to free spool. But by using the lever drag, when I'm letting the lure out behind the boat, whether it's got mono on it or braided, I back the tension down, get the lure in the water, let it start pulling up, And then I start bringing that lever forward just enough to where I want it to hold that lure. The object with a lever drag is not to put it all the way to the fight setting. Don't go all the way to strike. Just put it up just a little bit, just till you stop that lure from pulling any more line out of the rod once you have it where you want it. Now, it's in the rod holder. It's set there. The fish hits. He starts taking line out. I can pick it up. I can slam it into the strike setting, set my hook, and fight the fish from there, or I can even back it down a little bit once I set the hook. The other thing I do sometimes is I'll leave it right where I had it with the drag, pick the rod up, kind of lean forward with it, and then put my thumb on the spool, set the hook, and let go with my thumb right away. Because now I know I've got a very light setting. And I don't have to worry about missing, coming back to the light setting and hitting free spool.
I've done that before too.
Yeah. So what I want to do is just utilize that lever, but I still go back to the human contact where I put my thumb up against the spool, set the hook, let go of my thumbs, and now I can adjust that lever up and down to where I want it, you know, because when the fish first starts to fight really green, he's mean, he's ready to go, he's going to do his big speed runs. After you're into the fight for a while, you're not going to have that power to deal with. So you can use a little more drag. You can put a little more boots to them, slow them down just a little bit more. But that's usually halfway through the fight.
Yeah, and king mackerel are very notorious for kind of being a little bit of sleepers right in that first couple of runs, because they'll do a really hard run, and then they slow down. And just when you think you're starting to get them coming back and you're gaining line, they'll either run right straight back at you, or they turn around and haul out line all over again like it's a fresh hit.
All right. King mackerel's hooked up. You've been trolling. You've got a Rapala lure that goes down, say, 30 feet on the back right rod holder. On the left right rod holder, I've got a lure that's going to go down, say, 15 feet. On the forward holder between those are the two back holders. On my two deepest lures closest to the boat in the very back rod holders right by the engines. Because if they're forward of that, the line's going down so sharp of an angle to reach that depth, if you turn the boat wrong, get hit a wave wrong, you're going to have your line and your prop. So I want those on the very back of the boat, the ones that run the deepest. Now, the right-hand side, I always put my deepest one. The left-hand side's a little further away from the boat and not running as deep, so it's farther away and a little shallower. That allows those lines to pass back and forth by each other. Now, the midship rod holders, I'm going to stick let's say something that's going to go down 2 to 4 foot. And on the left side of that, I'm going to have something that's splashing right on the top. So I might just pull a regular spoon on the midship right-hand side. On the midship left-hand side, I'm going to do some kind of top water. Could be a dolphin getter, skipping plug, anything that's going to stay by the top.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. The only thing I like to mix into that also is a cedar plug. I really like the cedar plug.
Midship left. Stays pretty close. Or midship right.
Yeah.
It'll go under and above, but yeah. Depending on your speed, you slow down a little bit, it'll drop a little bit underwater for you.
Yeah, I just like it because it's a stupid lure and it catches fish, so that's what I enjoy about it.
What's your favorite color?
Unpainted, just a plain old cedar color.
Isn't it amazing that probably one of the best fish-catching trolling lures in the world is a chunk of wood with a bit of lead on the front and a hook? Yeah. Unpainted, it's just cedar. It's got a lead nose cone, the line goes through, then it's got a rounded cedar body, and the line goes through there. You put a hook on the back of it, and you got a fish catching lure. It's a piece of wood and a chunk of lead.
Yeah.
So
how does it make any sense? Because I mean, worldwide, that unpainted cedar plug performs extremely well.
There's very few fish species that you can't catch with a cedar plug. I've always found that amazing.
I just don't understand why the unpainted one, because the painted ones are...
You can get them, they're beautiful.
They're sharp looking.
Yeah, but the unpainted one doesn't catch fishermen. When they come in and they see the unpainted wood plug, a lot of people think, well, I should take that home and paint it then.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not a do-it-yourself kit.
Yeah.
This isn't a paint-by-numbers hobby kit. Leave the darn thing alone. For some reason or other, the raw wood and the unpainted lead, they rock. They work great.
Yep.
And another trick that I've learned over the last couple of years with a cedar plug, too, is you can actually put a scent in it, or guys will actually soak it in Manhaden oil overnight. And even the painted ones, it'll still work because the inside is unpainted, and it'll absorb into the wood and constantly leave out just a little bit of scent. So if you get a fish at Mike's short strike, you might have a chance for him to come back and hit at it a second time.
I've always been of the opinion it's the oil from the cedar, the smell of the cedar, that may help it catch.
Yeah, I never thought about that.
I don't know. I mean, why else would they hit a piece of wood?
I don't know.
Doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't.
So I was thinking maybe the cedar smell itself.
Yeah.
But it could be a visual hit. I don't know.
Just a very bizarre lure that works so darn well.
Yeah, if you're going to troll for kings, you have to have a couple of those in your tackle box.
Oh, absolutely.
And get them in the water.
I used to use king getters. They don't make them anymore. It's kind of like a spoon plug. And years ago, they had lures that were made out of bent metal. And for all practical purposes, they were kind of a spoon, but they were bent in a U-shaped, more like a taco shape because it's longer bent up. And they would dive, but it had all the glint because it was just, you know, silver or gold-plated metal, but it had treble hooks in it. And the spoon plugs,
I don't know which one you're talking about,
were great. And right. They made them bigger and called them king getters.
Right.
And they just fell out of fashion. They were still catching fish. You catch as many fish with an old king getter as you will with any of the brand new lures, and they were less money. But just that stamped piece of metal, people didn't believe in it. You know, you got to have this cool looking holograph thing. And I get it, all that stuff's cool and it looks nice, and I sell that stuff too, but I miss the king getters.
I forgot all about those.
Went on the internet, you could probably, you know, antique king getter lure. You know,
right?
But they were actually called king getters. If you're going to anchor up or drift, do you want to anchor or drift if you're going to fish kings with bait?
You can do it both ways, but honestly, I'd probably prefer to drift or very slow troll if I was going to use some type of live bait.
How do you do it drifting?
I'm just going to basically free line the bait fish. I'm going to try to catch blue runners or cigar minnows or even larger Spanish sardines, something that likes to stay high up in the water column.
Okay, how are you getting those on sabiki? How are you getting those?
Yeah, I'm going to probably try a sabiki because you're going to see some of these schools of bait fish that are out there. And usually a good rule of thumb is you know, heading towards a reef, because more often than not, your bait fish are going to be schooled up around a lot of the reefs, whether they're man-made or whether they're natural. And that's going to draw in predators, so it gives you a good chance to pick up the bait. But there are a lot of stone crab pots out there right now, so you have those opportunities also.
Already?
Yeah, it's the first, October 1st, they put them out.
Oh, wow. I forget. I tell you, I've had...
Yeah.
Yeah, one of those weeks. It has been tough.
Yeah.
I like putting one under a float. Now, I use the crappie fishing bobber stop because I might want that float, you know, 5 feet above the bait fish. I might want it 25 feet above, but I'm using a regular type line through bobber float. And if I don't have a bobber stop for it, all I'm going to do is put the bait fish on, put him over the boat. I do a quick arm measurement, you know, 3 foot at a time, you know, okay, there's 3, 6, 9. And let's say I want to get him down 25 feet. Then I put the bobber on and just start letting slack out, letting it drift away from the boat. Because either the current's going to take it away, or if I'm anchored up, the current will take it away from me. So right. Once I get it where I want it, I just put the, set the reel with the drag on it to where I want that, and then just leave it set out there. And when I'm reeling it in, you do have to remember, take the bobber off, and then finish your fight. You still got, you know, anywhere from 5 to 30 feet of line out there. So just remember to take the bobber off. As it gets up by the boat, just swing it in. Have your friend pull the pegs and take your bobber off, put it back on. But I do that trick a lot because I don't always have bobber stops with me. So the bobber stop, you can reel it all in. It's a very nice package. But if I don't have that, I'm still going to have one under a float, determining how deep that fish can dive. Because when you've got a bait fish on there, I don't want him running down onto the reef and hiding in the bottom on something. Yeah. I want him up in the water column.
Yeah, you get snagged up every time and you're just constantly re-rigging.
Well, if he hides from my fish, he's not doing me any good. He is supposed to be sacrificial. I am the high priest. He is my sacrifice. I'm sacrificing to Poseidon your life. Okay?
Gotcha.
My life's more valuable, so your life, you go. Isn't that what they did it years ago?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Speaking of weird stuff years ago, prop scars. If you're out on the grass flats, and now this can happen anywhere around, and we were wondering because on the east side of the harbor right now, there is a whole bunch of stakes put in the ground. Now, they could be wooden, they could be PVC, but little stakes that are marking all over, very random pattern. Now, the last time we saw anything like that, some giant intellect from get a government grant and put up poop sticks.
Right.
And I said it right, poop sticks. They literally thought they could get the grass to grow if they put a lot of little sticks up out of the water so the birds would land on them and poop, and that would fertilize the seagrass. Obviously, this... Luckily, we're not into that. This is actually marking areas for grass, seagrass renourishment.
Right.
But they're doing it different, aren't they, Robert?
Yeah. I mean, they actually did talk about using the poop sticks, but there's so much controversy of does it really work with the urea coming out of the birds?
Is it actually? It would kill more sea, in my opinion. Bird poops, raw bird poop like that, mm-hmm. would kill more seagrass than it would benefit.
I would think so, but you know, there is still that discussion of a 50-50. Is the urea actually helping benefit that area? But then other ones were arguing, well, is it actually growing back because of the fact that boaters are avoiding those spots because the stick is in the way.
There's all sticks there, yeah.
So,
let's just put up a bunch of sticks and that'll keep people out so the grass grew better.
Yeah, so that's kind of their argument right now. So that's why there's just sticks over there on the east side. They decided not to put the little flat stand on top to promote more birds standing on it.
Well, what they're doing over there on the east side is they're planning on redoing the seagrass, maybe not by planting more grass there.
Yeah.
They're going to be digging a boating channel out into Pirate Harbor. So now they're planning on capturing some of the surface sand from there.
Yeah. Yeah, they do, what do they call it? It's basically, essentially, they put it in a
biodegradable pantyhose.
Yeah, it's a type of pantyhose material that holds the active live sand.
Right, so they're going to be taking it right out of the surface where it's from that area,
mm-hmm.
and then
moving it in and laying it into the trench of the prop scar, because the prop scar isn't just cutting the weeds. It actually goes down and actually, like, almost like you're using a rototiller in a garden. I mean, you're actually opening up the sand and leaving a complete scar there. So this pantyhose filled with sand, they lay it in that prop scar to help bring the entire surface level back up to even with the surrounding seagrass. So, because our seagrasses grow off of rhizomes, which means they shoot off of their roots spread out a little bit, and babies pop up off of those roots and spread out that way. Having that sand level to it will help promote it to grab into each other and start spreading across.
So basically, they're going to backfill with what they take out of the first layers of they're digging that canal or boat passageway through mm-hmm. Pirate Harbor. They're just going to take some of that sand, put it in these things, and backfill the prop scars with them?
Yep.
Okay. I go along with that, I guess.
And being in the pantyhose type material will actually hold it in place because it is soft sand and you're putting it into a spot where there is no water flow. They don't want it to erode right out. That's why it's so hard for that grass to grow back in some of those spots, because once those prop scars are there, the tide wants to follow the path of least resistance.
And so, it's one of the arguments that not all prop scarring, too much is not a good thing, but a little bit, too much is a bad thing, but a little bit could actually be a good thing in areas that are very overgrown with seagrass and all this other kind of stuff. A prop scar here and there can actually help the water flow. It can actually provide hunting places for different fish where they can capture their prey. It can, like potholes, sand, you got a very heavily grassed area, and then you have this little depression on there that's full of white sand. And a few prop scars can actually be a beneficial thing, just as a few bare potholes on the flats offer the same type of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely create
just
highways
and
ambush points.
Just because you say prop scar doesn't mean it's a horrible thing.
No.
It doesn't have to be bad. I can tell you that one of the hardest things in the world to realize is that, contrary to what you hear on the news and all the media, everything is not bad. There, you can find something good if you look around a little bit. You know,
yeah,
and even with prop scars, some of them are bad, some of them are good, some of them are helpful, some of them aren't. It's not a one-size-fits-all question.
Yeah.
Beach renourishment, what they're doing there is they're taking the sand from that area and putting it back in some of these scars where they think there's a little too much scarring, trying to regrow the area. Beach renourishment, is there any detriments or benefits of beach renourishment?
Well, first of all, I'm going to correct your terminology. I'm looking at the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, and they've got a whole paragraph here about not calling it beach renourishment. It's beach nourishment.
Nourishment.
Nourishment, yeah, so.
Oh, how dare I? I feel so chastised. Don't do that again, Frank.
Well,
Personally, I think they should have beach denourishment.
Yeah, well, I would think so. This is the Department of Environmental Protection, and they're talking about something that's really a tourist problem, about how much beach space are we going to have. And we do have a lot of erosion. We've had a lot more storms, bigger storms. There's been a lot more development along the beaches.
Define that a lot more since when?
I'm reading what they're saying here. In the last
that's the problem
in the last
with government
20 years,
sites, is they're just stupid. Government, people...
So they're talking about beach erosion. So we know that we've had a lot of beach erosion.
I just want to know how many hurricanes we had in the 1300s, 1400s, 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, and 1800s. And that one person can tell me that there's more storms now than there was then. I don't get it.
Well, I think that there's a lot more jetties and piers and everything else that affects how the sand moves along and moves up and down the beaches. And it's a fluid thing. I mean, it's not concrete, guys. The
sand moves.
Sand moves, and it goes where it wants to go.
Now, do they say this is a good thing, a bad thing, a good witch, a bad witch, or a sandwich?
Environmental Protection thinks it's a great idea. We need to do this. And they've spent, in the last 20 years, they've spent $1.5 billion on
beach nourishment.
Of course they
think it's a good thing. That's like
$500 million just last year out of the state fund, which is a 50-50. So that's $100
million? $100
million. Yeah, that's $1,000
million. $1,000
million. Yeah.
I got to tell you, only someone who calls themselves Environmental Protection Agency could be that arrogant and that stupid.
Well, let's talk about two different beaches in Florida. The most famous beach is Siesta Key.
Okay.
Beautiful, white, gorgeous.
Let's do it this way. Pick a beach on the west coast of Florida and pick a beach on the east coast of Florida.
I was going to say just pick right along this coast.
No. There's a reason for this.
Okay.
So you get one on this side. I'll take Daytona Beach for $500, Alex.
Okay.
All right. How do they re-nourish the beach where you're at?
They run a pipe way out to a barge, and then they pump the slurry up onto the beach from that barge.
Right. How do they do it on the Atlantic side?
Oh, I don't know.
They truck it in from sand pits inland Florida.
Ah.
They bring it in a dump truck. So that's why I was talking about east side, west side. On the Atlantic, they found it's less expensive for them because they have to constantly keep replenishing these beaches all along that whole east coast. So what you're looking at is two different things. Now, why do they think it's a good thing on this coast to pump that sand from out there back up on the beach?
Mm-hmm. I have no idea. I just know that when you pump sand on the beach, you kill everything that lives on the beach.
I'm with you 100% on that one.
And that's why I say you look at Siesta Key, and then you look at Casperson. And Casperson, as far as I know, has not been nourished or re-nourished in a long time. You go to Casperson, you see ghost crabs, you see all kinds of
cool coquinas stuff. And sand
yeah,
fleas.
And lots of birds running along the beach and feeding and just a natural Florida beach. You go to Siesta Key and all you see is people.
Right.
And this white sugar sand that doesn't exist on any other beach, and it's only because they pumped it in from that great distance.
Well, and even when they just this year did Boca Grande and pumped it in from out there, and it was just starting to get better where you were starting to see a few more of the coquinas and a few more of the sand fleas, and people don't realize you changed the entire ecosystem because you took it from 20, 30, 40, 50 feet of water. That has an entirely different ecosystem. It's got more sea cucumbers, little starfish, little shrimp, and stuff like that that live in that. You pump that onto the beach, you smother out the coquinas and sand fleas that need that water splashing on them, washing away, exposing them, changing all that whole nutrient level.
All of a sudden, they're within inches of the surface, right at the water's edge, and then in 3 minutes they're 3 feet under the sand and 100 feet from the water.
Right. And I think, you know, you had brought up a point a couple of, probably several years ago now, about I think a lot of beach erosion has a lot to do with tourists too, when you were talking about Terry with the shells.
Well, the reason we have so much beach erosion. I was trying to get to the other word, like I say, having a rough week. Trying to be positive and happy for the radio program. The reason there's so much erosion is when I first went to the beach, you would walk from your vehicle, cross the sand, and then there was about 15, 20 feet of big broken seashells, and then there was another 15 feet or so to the water. Now, you remember that, right, RJ?
I do.
And there is not one beach that has that anymore. Every time a shell washes up, somebody picks it up and puts it in their purse or their pocket or whatever, or their little beach, you know, their little shell bucket. And it goes and it's dumped in somebody's shell box in their living room or in their garden. The shells go away immediately. Now, over eons, millions or billions of years, as the oceans and the clams and all that, the bigger shells were washed up, and they sat on top, and as the waves broke on there, the bigger shells broke the force of the wave and kept it from dragging all the sand back out. And so more sand would settle, and those shell lines kept getting further and further away from shore. That's how the beaches built up sand. But once all those shells were gone, every time a wave hits, it just grabs all that sand and drags it back with them. And we figured that out years ago, and I tried explaining it to the feds, and the only reason I couldn't get anything done is I could not find one picture with that shell laying on it. It's really hard to do because you're talking about going through photographs. It's not like you can scan, you know, and type in on the internet beach pictures with shells, you know.
Right, and we're throwing sand on top of everything. So, you know, the natural environment that exists on the beach and has been for years suddenly and within days gets completely destroyed. You change the pattern of fish moving up and down. Your sandbars are gone. Everything's been covered. And then when you walk along places where they don't do beach nourishment, you see sandbars and way more nature and way more
fish.
Yeah, way more fish, and all you get with beach nourishment is,
Nourish beach.
Yeah, and more places for tourists to put a beach chair. That's all you get with it.
So
we're not.
It's a money issue.
Of course, it is.
Tourism dollars versus the cost of pumping sand up there.
Well, and fishermen contribute a certain amount to the economy, but the beachgoers contribute a whole lot more to the economy than the fishermen do. So that's why I think you're seeing we've got all these projects. We're willing to spend $1 billion plus on throwing sand on the beach. And what do you get for it? You just get a wider beach where you can put more beach tiles.
So now, do you think there's...
Which eventually erodes away because the way it's set up...
Especially when they do it in the spring.
Well, and nature
says... I mean,
I
want to have that contract. I want to go out and pump a whole ton of sand, tons and tons of sand up on the beach in the springtime so I know I have to do it again in the fall.
Yep.
Because there's going to be a storm go by and take it all away. None of that stuff should be done until September, October. You know, I mean, at least October. Go out there, just start pumping the sand up. Okay. By November, you're done. You got a month to get all the sand up there you can.
Right. Well, the problem you're having with that is you're not planning on tourist season.
You're
not going to nourish the beach in October when everybody's down here.
But it only starts in October. But the problem is every time you get a storm, it's all gone. So what's the difference? I would rather them see me going along and they would think it's cool watching all the sand pump up. Here's my question. On the East Coast, they bring it in dump trucks from like a gravel pit. It's a sand pit. They dig big holes and truck it out with a dump truck and dump it on the beach over there. And on this coast, they're picking up with a dredge, which nothing lives through that, boys and girls. This is a giant pump. They've got to be, it's pumped up through there, and well, maybe something could live if it was small enough, and then blasted through a pipe and dropped in on the beach where they run it over with a bulldozer. Both sides get bulldozed. But one's brought in by dump truck and one's brought up by sand barge. The reason we're talking about this is because if you know where the beach renourishment is, you know the fishing's not going to be as good. You can look for a beach that has not had this nourishment on it. Why don't we just say the dollars pumped on it?
Right.
So that's one of the things. But now, which is worse, Robert, being or better, dumped in by dump truck? Or pumped up by dredge from out further on that land, or would it make a difference?
I think the only real benefit of pumping the live sand up, you know, from offshore versus digging it out of a pit is that it does have its own natural anaerobic bacteria in it that will at least help speed up the process for the future life to grow into it. But I don't know to what extent.
All right, RJ?
I just think if you're gonna monkey with the natural process here, you're going to take sand that exists way out with bacteria and microbes and things like that, and you're going to pump it up right up on shore. What does that affect? We don't know, but does it affect red tide? Does it affect algae? Does it
could
affect
the beach renourishment be causing the red tide?
Oh, my God, don't say that. I did not say
beach
that.
Beach nourishment causes red tide.
Well, that's a good way to get it to stop. But anyway, that's my point, is you've changed the natural balance, whether it's got natural stuff in it or it's like putting the poop sticks out with the urea. Did it make a difference? Was it positive? Was it negative? Nobody seems to want to think that out. The other thing is when you pump it, the critters that go through the pumping process don't survive. They don't survive getting buried on the beach.
And
from where they were. So now you've destroyed two ecosystems at the same time, your deep water ecosystem and your beach system. So I'm thinking, I don't like this at all. I really don't.
I mean, it's going to be done. And, you know, let's face it, who lives on the water? Rich people. Who are usually part of the rich people? Politicians. Every politician talking to you about, you've got to go after that 1%. They are part of the 1%. I mean, so usually if there's a house on a beach, 50-50 shot it belongs to a politician. So you know they're getting more sand on the beach. Now, Robert, Number two, what's the cool thing to happen in the harbor this week? We King Mackerel in the Gulf of Mexico. A lot of them out there. Go out, have some fun with the kings. What's number two?
Tarpon.
Tarpon were gone. Don't tell me this.
Yeah, well, that's got me perplexed myself. I mean, for the last 4 weeks, they've been invisible, and now all of a sudden they dumped right back into the holes in the harbor like a couple thousand fish.
All right, so good tarpon fish in the middle of the harbor. Yeah. Redfish. What's going on with redfish?
Oh, geez, where aren't the redfish? You know,
what do you mean? They're all dead.
Yeah.
That's why they're closed, because we have no redfish and everything's dead.
Yeah.
Don't come to Florida because there's absolutely no redfish.
It's amazing out there right now. It's one of the best redfish
seasons in decades.
Yes. There's schools of big bull reds up and down the intercoastal.
And public service announcement. That was a bit of sarcasm by Frank. There's a ton of redfish out there.
They're off the beaches. They're in the passes. They're in the ICW. And those are just different loose schools scattered everywhere. But there's a lot of individual and double fish, you know, twos swimming around in Turtle Bay, Bull Bay, up and down the East Wall, West Wall. I mean, it's...
When he said double fish, I was...
I know, that's why I corrected myself.
Two-headed fish and, you know, chewing gum, I don't know. But a lot of redfish. What's the main thing they're eating right now?
The schools are hitting everything. It can be a spoon. It can be a chewing gum wrapper. It doesn't matter. If it wiggles and flashes, they're eating it. But the individual fish that are up in the bushes and out on the flats... Cut ladyfish, cut mullet, and crabs are working incredibly well right now.
Spanish mackerel.
From Cape Hayes all the way through Boca Grande Pass and out into 20 miles offshore with all that bait fish that's out there. Now, just basically look for the birds, look for any bait activity, start trolling around. And the amount of life that is in basically the middle of the harbor all the way out through the pass is unbelievable, because there's groups of fish blitzing on the surface. One group is Spanish mackerel, another group is ladyfish, another group is blue runners, and another group is bluefish. And then you've got some groups that are just the hodgepodge of all the above. Inside the harbor.
Oh, inside the harbor, gotcha.
It's just...
Jack Crevel.
Even Jack Crevel, yeah. It's crazy how much activity is just going on out there. And then you hit the near shore, offshore, and that's where you got the bonita, the kings and the Spanish all intermingling together. It's pretty impressive. And guys are catching Spanish mackerel up to 23, 24 inches. A lot of them are in the high teens, but a few of them, and I had to double check to see if they were baby king or juvenile king mackerel, but they were actually Spanish as best I could tell from the pictures. So it's pretty good sized fish around.
All right. Sharks. What's going on with shark fishing?
Because of all that life that we're seeing in the harbor with those mackerel and jacks and blue runners, the sharks have been pretty impressive. There's 6 foot, 5 to 6 foot bull sharks, 3 to 5 foot black tip sharks, a few lemons, even heard of a hammerhead that was caught this week out by Boquilla off the bar there in a school of blue runners. You know, so these sharks are around, and anywhere where you're seeing bird activity or bait blitzing on the bouncing off the surface, they're doing well. And then also out there, same way, going offshore a little bit. There's been one guy got railed bad. He's a good shark fisherman, and he was out there playing around, and he actually had to have all of his line replaced this week because he actually got hit by a shark that he couldn't stop, and before he pulled the anchor, he had to break the line. He got most of his line back, but it had dumped 3/4 of his 50 wide.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, he's a pretty darn good fisherman. He's actually out there with one of the biologists right now.
So there's some big sharks out
there. There's a couple.
Not like the 2 to 4 footers we were dealing with a week ago.
Yeah, no, the average size on the bull seems to be around 6 foot. The average size on the black tips are 4 to 5 foot right now, but there's a few... What the heck was that moment's going on out there?
All right.
A couple guys have been bit clean off, too. Like, not even, they hit the little click and nothing.
Not like the pacus, just
reel it up
and just bit the line off.
Yeah, just clean cut.
I wasn't going back there.
I was trying to figure out how we were going to change the subject real quick. What about Snook?
Yeah. Okay.
How about those Mets?
Okay. Yeah, the Cubs are doing good this year. All right. Back to the tarpon. What are the tarpon hitting on?
They're catching them on bait busters. Ladyfish are working well, but the ladyfish are getting hit by some of the sharks out there, so it's a little on the frustrating side. But there's also been some schools of threat, bigger tarpon-sized thread fins down towards Cape Hayes and over towards Boquilla that guys have been sabikiing up and using them. So it's kind of an all over the map, and some of those fish are doing that slurping thing where they're just coming up and feeding on all the little tiny minnows. So I think
here's a thought. I bought those spinners, the lake trout spinners.
Oh, yeah.
Or the walleye spinners or whatever they were. Mm-hmm. They're like, they got several little bent metal fish imitations on them that if you were going to troll them or even cast them, this might be the time to do that. When they start slurping, this would be a good time. Maybe put a Clark number 4 on it, or one of the big Lure Jensen spoons, or maybe that big King spoon, that big Gator King spoon.
I'd probably put the big Gator King spoon on it, just because that hook is pretty impressive to me, so it would stay stuck.
You got that big Gator King spoon you could put on the back of this, and it's just, you got a leader with a couple of umbrella arms, and you've got these fish dangling off them. And the neat thing about it, it just, if you took a just piece of metal and stamped it into a fish shape, kind of almost like a ballyhoo shape, and then twisted it so as you pulled it, it would just spin. That would be, this is a time I want to go try that.
Yeah, that might be actually worthwhile. You know, they're just so all over the map. You know, it's worth going out there and trying just about everything right now because it is impressive.
Yeah, that's cool. I mean, let's see. I think it's about time to end the show. I don't hear the music.
Take advantage of the beautiful weather.
Yeah, it's some beautiful weather out there. Beautiful days. Hopefully all your luck is doing way better than mine. And Fish and Frank here, Robert in the chair across from me, and RJ in command and control. Listen to us on a radio station near you or on the one you're listening to now. Thank you very much. Bye. Fish, 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 fish.